Good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining our telebriefing. I am Kimberly Aline, Senior Director of Communications at Families USA, and I have the pleasure of framing today's discussion and welcoming you all. This Thursday, March 14th, Federal Judge James Bozerg of the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia will hear oral arguments on the legality of Medicaid work requirements in Arkansas and Kentucky. Today, experts from Families USA, the National Health Law Program, also known as NHELP, and Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families will discuss the national implications of these oral arguments and potential decisions. You will hear first from Elliot Fishman. Elliot is Senior Director of Health Policy here at Families USA. Next, you'll hear from Leonardo Cuello from the National Health Law Program, where he is Director of Health Policy. And finally, you'll hear from Loretta Alexander. She is Director of Health Policy at Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families. Our presentations will be followed by a Q&A session for reporters, and we'll also offer this telebriefing as a recording on our website following today's call. With that, I'll turn it over to Elliot.
Thanks, Kimberly. Let's start with a Kentucky hearing. In June of last year, the court ruled that the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services did not have legal authority to approve a request by Kentucky's Governor Bevin to tie Medicaid eligibility to onerous work requirements and new administrative burdens. Importantly, the court found that federal review and approval of any Medicare waiver needs to be in terms of the explicit definition of Medicaid in statute, which is the provision of, quote, medical assistance, unquote. Medical assistance is literally the name at the top of Title 19 of the Social Security Act. It is the name of the Medicaid statute. And Judge Bozerg affirmed that medical assistance means paying for medical care and health services. That is, providing health coverage. And the judge said that the Department of Health and Human Services had failed to consider the impacts of the new program on coverage. This is a quote from the judge's opinion. Secretary never adequately considered whether the waiver would in fact help the state furnish medical assistance to its citizens, a central objective of Medicaid. So the judge vacated the approval, and he established that going forward, whether a proposal would, quote, help provide coverage, unquote, is how CMS must justify its approval. So, since that ruling took effect, Kentucky has resubmitted its waiver with no substantive changes, and that gives CMS a choice. CMS has to either show that work requirements / community engagement waivers actually do somehow promote Medicaid coverage, or CMS must come up with a way to challenge the district court's ruling that providing Medicaid coverage is the major objective of the Medicaid program. And given that, according to Kentucky's own estimates, an approved waiver would result in 95,000 people losing Medicaid coverage, demonstrating that this waiver will promote Medicaid coverage would appear to be difficult. So, CMS is directly challenging the idea that the objective of Title 19, the medical assistance title of the Social Security Act, is actually medical assistance. It's literally what the law is called. But CMS is trying to reintroduce the idea that it tried last year, that Medicaid is bad for your health since it supposedly disincentivizes employment, and that health is an objective of Medicaid, so taking Medicaid away serves the objectives of Medicaid. So granted, CMS didn't have great legal options here. They're defending something that is just illegal on its face. But even given those lack of options, a frontal assault on the basic objectives of Medicaid as stated in the statute is still shocking and brazen. And note, this is not a one-off legal strategy for Kentucky. CMS has subsequently incorporated the identical language in approvals of similar waivers in Wisconsin, New Hampshire, Maine, and Michigan. That's Kentucky. Next, Arkansas, with oral arguments on Thursday. This is the only one of the work requirements that has been implemented. So So the hearing on Thursday is to stop the ongoing massive disenrollment of people from Arkansas Medicaid due to the failure to complete new and extra statutory documentation requirements. As has been widely reported, in just the first 4 months of disenrollments under Arkansas Works implementation at the end of 2018, 18,000 low-income adults in Arkansas lost Medicaid coverage. But it has been less reported that Arkansas was able to exempt many of its expansion beneficiaries from new reporting requirements using old employment data. The state didn't have to do that. Arkansas was trying to hold down disenrollments, and it still lost 18,000 people in 4 months. That's because more than 80% of people who were subject to the reporting requirements are not interacting with the state's website at all, and less than 4% are entering in work hours information. In October 2018, seeing month after month of extremely concerning outcomes in Arkansas, the Nonpartisan Medicaid and CHIP Payment and Access Commission, MACPAC, for the first time in the legislative branch agency's history, sent a public letter to the Secretary of Health and Human Services, Alex Azar, calling on HHS to suspend disenrollments in Arkansas. So where does this leave waivers for Medicaid work/community engagement requirements and eligibility lockouts? Well, obviously the federal courts are going to have a major say, and that's our focus this week. But we should note that we have now seen Republican legislatures in West Virginia and Wyoming reject work requirements waivers. We've seen new Democratic governors in Maine, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Kansas push back on them. So there's a growing political dynamic against these. This week's hearings are obviously important on their own terms, but they play into that changing political environment as well, and we'd be glad to talk about that more during the question and answer session.
Thank you. To Leonardo Cuello from the National Health Law Program.
Thank you so much. Thanks, everybody, for joining us today, and good morning. My name is Leo Cuello. I'm the Director of Health Policy at the National Health Law Program. For those of you who don't know the National Health Law Program, we are a nonprofit firm that works to advance access to quality health care for low-income and underserved individuals. And together with fantastic lawyers at the Kentucky Equal Justice Center, Legal Aid of Arkansas, the Southern Poverty Law Center, and with support from the law firm Jenner & Block, we represent the Medicaid enrollees fighting to keep their health insurance in Kentucky and Arkansas. Before I begin talking about the cases, I just want to be clear about where I sit in the equation. I'm a lawyer, but I'm on the National Health Law Program's policy team, so I'm not one of the litigators who writes the briefs or will be at the table in court. That means I'm not the right person to get into all of the litigation strategy details. And of course, I don't speak for the full team attorneys from all of the organizations I mentioned. That team of litigators has issued a media advisory, and members of that litigation team will be available for press interviews following the oral arguments. So that's where you can kind of parse out some of the deeper strategic questions. With that said, let's talk about the cases and arguments scheduled for this week. As Elliot laid out for you, the Trump administration has approved a set of waivers in both Kentucky and Arkansas that will result in thousands of people losing their health insurance. In the case of Kentucky, it will be upwards of 100,000 people or more. In the case of Arkansas, 18,000 people have already lost their insurance, and thousands more are potentially weeks away from losing their health insurance. These policies include terminating people who don't document they are working. They include premiums for people in or near poverty and coverage lockouts that prevent people from getting their insurance back. They include eliminating retroactive coverage and more. They are bad policies for healthcare. The reason we're in court is that they're also not legal under Medicaid law. Put simply, the cases argue that the Trump administration lacks the legal authority to implement these policies. The Medicaid statute does not allow them. In some cases, it specifically prohibits these harmful policies, and HHS's attempt to implement them through Section 1115 authority is an abuse of their authority. The authority under the statute, this 1115 authority, is only allowed for true healthcare experiments that help furnish coverage. The administration's policies, which the evidence shows will result in hundreds of thousands of people losing coverage, have no valid experimental purpose and obviously are the exact opposite of helping to furnish coverage. The Kentucky approval that is before the court was already vacated in essentially the form, the same form as it is in now. In the first Kentucky case, which was decided in June of last year, the judge vacated the approval, finding that it was not legal. And in that decision, the judge noted that HHS had an extensive record with thousands of public comments, the overwhelming majority of which provided detailed evidence about the harmful nature of these waiver policies. And thus, given this clear record and the lack of meaningful evidence supporting the administration's policies, the judge found that HHS's approval was arbitrary and capricious. HHS then turned around and reapproved those Kentucky waivers, making no substantive material changes, and thus we are in court again challenging the reapproval of what is essentially more of the same. And, of course, now we are adding into the mix the similar Arkansas approval that appeared along the way. At its core, the Kentucky decision boils down to the following. HHS failed to consider the evidence in its own record when it made this decision, much less to explain how the staggering amount of evidence showing harm could lead to a conclusion that these policies would promote coverage for enrollees. Now, it's impossible to predict what this court or any court will do, but we hope that the court will again strike down the waivers in Kentucky and Arkansas because HHS has not responded to the court's decision in the first case. HHS still has not considered its own record, which again is a voluminous pile of evidence showing that these policies harm coverage. As a result, the briefs argue that HHS's approvals are not based on a reasoned review of the evidence. Instead, they are predetermined policies that desperately seek some justification, and there is no legitimate justification to be found in the record or the approvals. To be sure, the administration raises all of the same arguments they did the first time. HHS argues that work will promote health. But the court rejected this argument the first time because it concluded that, of course, the purpose of Medicaid is to provide coverage, not just anything that might promote health. And, of course, there's still no convincing evidence supporting what HHS says and no effort to address the clear evidence in the record that says the exact opposite is true. Taking away health insurance will prevent many people from working and will certainly harm health. There is one of our plaintiffs is a clear example of this. HHS, again, argues that the waivers will promote independence, yet promoting independence was also found to not be the purpose of Medicaid, and again, the evidence is against HHS on this point. HHS, again, argues it will save money through these waivers. But saving money by terminating eligible people is not a valid experimental premise, nor is it consistent with the purpose of Medicaid. HHS also, again, doubles down on its argument that if these waivers aren't approved, the whole Medicaid expansion will be canceled, and thus that is how the waivers benefit coverage. But first, of course, as was noted in the first case, that is a speculative theory. It assumes the government of Kentucky will do something that no one can predict or control. It assumes that it would be legal for them to do that. And we don't even know when these cases will finish and who will be in the Kentucky government at that time. We literally don't know who the governor of Kentucky will be when these cases come to their completion. And second, just imagine if the absolute disaster a court would create if it accepted this argument that otherwise, illegal and harmful policies should be approved because, or else Kentucky will cancel everyone's coverage. Any state could, at any time, pursue any policy if it just at the same time threatened that it would cancel everyone's coverage if it didn't get what it wanted. A court cannot ground Medicaid law in the willingness to make threats. So if we can kind of pull all of this together and summarize this for you, HHS's record is actually larger than it was in the first case, with the same overwhelming showing of terminations and harm. HHS has not looked more carefully at that evidence, if at all, and HHS has not provided any new or cogent explanation as to how these policies that result in all of these terminations promote coverage. Hence, these approvals are still arbitrary and capricious, and that is why we continue to believe that a court should not allow the waivers to stand. So with that, I'll just remind you that the litigators themselves will be available for comment after the hearing, and I welcome your questions when we get to Q&A. Thank you. Hello, is somebody on mute?
Thank you, Leonardo. We appreciate it. I'll turn it over now to Loretta Alexander, who is Health Policy Director at Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families. Loretta?
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Loretta Alexander, and I'm the Health Policy Director for Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families. Thank you, Families USA, for inviting Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families to participate in this discussion. The mission of Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families is to ensure that all children and their families have the resources and opportunities to lead healthy and productive lives and to realize their full potential. We serve as a voice for children at the Arkansas State Capitol and in Washington, D.C. We gather and analyze data to support public policy that serves all children and families, and we organize coalitions of diverse groups to drive change. Thus, Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families has advocated tirelessly to ensure that every individual in this state has access to good, quality health care, which is the reason that we've strongly opposed the work requirement policy. But before I speak specifically to the experience of those subject to the Arkansas Works reporting requirement, I will give you a brief history of the Arkansas Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act. In 2013, Arkansas made history in passing a bipartisan measure to extend health care coverage to low-income families by using federal dollars to purchase private insurance plans. It was called the Health Care Independence Program, or also known as the Private Options. The Private Option, which allowed individuals that are aged 19 to 64 years old with incomes up to 138% of the federal poverty level to enroll in private marketplace plans and use Medicaid funds to make the monthly premium payments. The Medicaid expansion program was renamed Arkansas Works in 2016 under the current governor, Asa Hutchinson. At the end of the 2017 Arkansas legislative session, Governor Hutchinson announced a proposal to make several changes to the Arkansas Works program, which included implementing work requirements or restrictions, that non-disabled participants had to be employed, and that they undergo job training or volunteer to qualify for works. These requirements would be like those imposed in the SNAP program, but allow certain exceptions for some people, including students and caregivers. CMS did approve the waiver, which took effect June 1, 2018. Key work reporting requirements are that people have to work 80 hours or they have to have 80 hours of work-related activities per month. The reporting deadline is the 5th of the following month for those 80 hours the previous month, and there are exemptions for those that are unable to work, but they are still required to report. So what the work requirements mean to low-income working Arkansans is that in order to keep their Medicaid coverage, they must engage in 80 hours of required work reporting activities. That includes job search activities, attending qualified health education classes, any full or part-time work, part-time school or vocational training, or volunteer work. These work reporting activities must be reported monthly to the Arkansas Department of Human Services. As I mentioned earlier, there are exemptions. The work reporting rules regarding exemptions are very complex. Persons receiving unemployment benefits or in school or vocational training full-time must report their exemption every 6 months. But those who are in drug and alcohol treatment or taking care of someone or themselves unable to work because of illness, injury, or disability must report their exemption every 2 months. Automatic exemptions includes persons that meet the work requirements for SNAP or TEA, which is welfare reform, parents living in households with children under 18, and persons age 50 and above. Other exemptions are for pregnancy, medically frail health status, American Indian, Alaska Native, and for good cause. In 2018, between September 1st and December 31st, 18,164 people lost their coverage. Coverage losses were the result of people not receiving notices, not having computer or internet access, not understanding how to navigate the portal to make the report online, limited broadband access in rural areas of Arkansas, transportation problems getting to the Arkansas Department of Workforce Service offices to participate in job training or job seeking. Others lost their coverage due to not meeting the 80-hour work requirements or combination of work and other activities. Some of the rural counties have limited employment and limited volunteer opportunities. According to a Kaiser Family Foundation report in 2015, Arkansas cut its uninsured rate among non-elderly adults nearly in half, from 27.5% to 15.6% between 2013 and 2014. And that's just the first year of the Affordable Care Act and the Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act in Arkansas. Also, according to a report from the Georgetown University Center for Children and Families, the uninsured rate for low-income adults in rural Arkansas counties fell by 23 percentage points, from 45% down to 22% by 2015, after the implementation of Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act. These gains are being rolled back by continuous disenrollment of adults from the Arkansas Works Medicaid program. And I will be happy to answer any questions you may have later on in the broadcast. Thank you.
Thank you, Loretta. So we'll move now to our Q&A session.
Thank you. If you would like to ask a question, please signal by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you are using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. A voice prompt on the phone line will indicate when your line is open. Please state your name before posing your question. Again, press star 1 to ask a question. We'll pause for just a moment to allow everyone an opportunity to signal for questions. There appears to be no questions at this time. There is still no one queued for a question at this time. I will pass the call back to the speakers.
Thank you, John. And thank you to all the speakers, Elliot, Leonardo, and Loretta. In case anyone has any additional questions following this telebriefing, you can contact me. My name is Kimberly Aline, and my email address is kaline, kalline at familiesusa.org. We will also make available for participants a recording of this call. We'll hang on a couple more minutes in case there are questions.
We have a question. Caller, your line is open. Please state your name and go ahead.
Hi, it's Dan Goldberg from Politico. I have a question if you could address sort of what the process might look like going forward, both what's at stake, obviously, from a national implication if the judge rules either for or against, and what an appeals process might look like, how long this might be in courts, that sort of thing, of what the future next few months, years looks like.
So, Leonardo, why don't you take that one first, and then we can follow up with the additional one.
Sure. So, you know, what's at stake in terms of a national implication? This case, these two cases are not, you know, setting the precedent that will finally determine this issue for posterity. So, you know, they're not going to be decisive with respect to waivers approved in other states. At the same time, certainly any judge looking at waivers in other states would be looking at this case and the reasoning used in this case, and drawing from that, and of course, if it was in the same court, then it would even be, you know, precedent that would be important to the judge. But I do think that, you know, the evidence is sort of coming in on these work requirements, and it is exactly consistent with what was in the comments when people commented. It's exactly consistent with what was in the record, which is these are a bad idea, you shouldn't do this. So I do think that, you know, there's kind of an emerging answer that these are really bad for coverage, which, you know, as we've said, is one of the driving factors in setting out the fact they're illegal. It's impossible to predict what the timelines on where these will go and whatnot. These are cases that move, so they could, you know, they could move pretty quickly through the courts. So it's not impossible that there could be appeals and, you know, decisions in those cases in 2019. But at the same time, because this issue is popping up in so many places and is so dynamic, it's really hard to predict what the path will look like.
So, Dan, this is Elliot from Families USA, and I would add that the governor of Kentucky, who initiated this waiver in Kentucky, that this waiver never went to the legislature, doesn't have to, in that Kentucky's Medicaid program gives a lot of executive branch authority. So that governor's up for reelection in November. He's been pursuing this waiver for essentially the entire term. That is important in thinking about the future of this waiver specific to Kentucky.
Thanks for your question, Dan. Are there any other questions?
As a reminder, if you would like to ask a question, please press star one. There are no further questions. As a reminder, if you would like to ask a question, please press star one on your telephone keypad. If you're using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Again, we will pause for another moment.
Thanks, John. We'll take another minute or two, and then we'll conclude the call. Okay, well, thank you everyone for joining us for this telebriefing with Families USA and InHelp and Arkansas Advocates for Families and Children and Families. If you find that you might have additional questions that you didn't think of during our time together, please feel free to follow up with me and I'll get your question routed to the appropriate party. It's Kimberly Alleen, kalleen@familiesusa.org. That's kalleen.org, and just a reminder that we will make this recording available on our website at familiesusa.org, and also Elliot Fishman will be at the court on Thursday for media availability following the conclusion of oral arguments, and he'll also be available later that afternoon as well to talk with reporters. So if there are no other questions, we'll close out. Another thank you to Elliot and Leonardo and Loretta for joining us today.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.